Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Welcome to Radio Islam Special Hajj Focus. And this year for our Hajj Safarnama, we're discussing the Russian Hajj Empire and the pilgrimage to Mecca. We're joined on the line now by Professor Aileen Kane, who is the author of this book published by Cornell University Press in December 2015. Good morning and welcome to Radio Islam, Professor Kane.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
Talking about those economic benefits, in your book you talk about the challenges faced by these travelers. So at the ports, you know, the type of food that they would encounter, the fact that they were treated so badly. What was an average citizen's experience like as they traveled through Russia to get to Hijaz?
So if you had, as is true today also, if you had a lot of money, your experience was certainly better. You had more choices of the kinds of routes you took. You could pay for a hotel. I know this from reading many Muslims, and these, of course, were people who were literate and educated, so exceptional. They weren't representative of most pilgrims. They wrote accounts of their pilgrimage, and they would describe taking the train and staying in hotels, and you know, these people for the most part also spoke Russian, which made it easier to navigate moving through Russia, you know, many different train stations and negotiating to get a hotel. But for the most part, based on the newspaper coverage that I read and government reports, there it was not surprisingly very challenging for your average person who didn't speak any language except his native language, traveling thousands of miles. Many people were cheated, people were sold tickets sometimes on steamships that didn't exist. This was another argument. The government is also, the Tsarist government is saying, we have to get involved in this because this is a mass migration and it's making us look bad because we claim to be tolerant of Islam officially and to support Islam, and here we are just sort of leaving our Muslim subjects to fend for themselves in this mass event. I mean, the most information we have, as far as I can tell, is in Odessa, which became a hub of the traffic, this city that was created by Catherine the Great in the late 18th century. It's today in Ukraine, and it's a port city. And this would be where Muslims would congregate to catch steamships. And there was a lot of crime of locals preying on the crowds, trying to sell them, tickets that were useless. But also this question of going, and those of us who've taken the train across Russia, when you take the train, sometimes the stations aren't. There's not much there, but when the train stops, you'll have villagers come and offer food, so maybe potatoes in newspaper, but also a lot of pork products. So this was not going to work if you were trying to keep halal. So there are many, many problems that they hadn't anticipated in involving sort of moving people through the empire through conditions that weren't really what they were used to or what they needed.
Yeah, that's so interesting. So if we're looking at like late 1800s, early 1900s, what was the average time it took to take the journey? I mean, you look at Ibn Battuta, it took him years to do his one. What would you say the average pilgrim would spend, the time they would spend to get to Hajj, traveling from the east?
So it suddenly becomes possible to do it rather quickly. I think so, you did have cases where people would get stranded and get caught for, weeks, and sometimes it's because they didn't have enough money or if the steamship service broke down. But I could say this, having read pilgrim memoirs, there was one from the late 19th century where, and part of this is also most pilgrims don't want to just go straight from their home. As again, today, if you are in London and you take a flight from Heathrow to Jeddah, you go, you do the Hajj, this is an example, and you go back home, it's very much a, you know, an A to B kind of trip. And in these days, many people would save up. This would be the one long distance trip they would take. This was sort of the chance of a lifetime. They wanted to stop along the way and visit mosques in Istanbul, for example, to visit shrines in Damascus and Jerusalem. So many people chose to make it a longer trip that could take a month. But it's possible by the early 20th century, because of railroads and steamships, you can get, for example, from Tashkent to Odessa in 8.5 days. And then maybe, you know, a week to get from, or less, to get from Odessa to Jeddah. So it's possible to go, you know, it could take less than a month to do almost the whole Hajj, which is just amazing. This has never been possible before.
Incredible. I'm looking at chapter 5 of your book, The Hajj and the Socialist Revolution, and I find this fascinating in that you mentioned that there were about 300,000 pilgrims, where that was the amount that peaked in the early 1900s. And then after World War I broke out in 1914, it ended the Tsarist government involvement in the Hajj. Tell us a little bit about this.
So the Tsarist government collapses during World War I, and then you get the Bolshevik Revolution, and you'll eventually get the Soviet government. And I think the assumption is, as you mentioned, there hasn't been much written on this before. There have been a couple articles that I read and benefited from in writing this book about the Hajj in Russia, and the assumption was, well, the government's involvement of it must, of course, have ended when the Tsarist Empire ended, because what you get next is a socialist government. You get communist Russia, which is officially atheist, and officially, you know, religion is not allowed. But I thought originally that the book would end during World War I, certainly with the Bolshevik Revolution, but I found all this amazing stuff in Odessa about, there was this brief period in the 20s where the Soviets actually embrace a vision of the Hajj that the Tsarist government had. And again, there weren't too many years between the collapse of the Tsarist government and this plan in the 20s. So there were people around, presumably, who remembered the Tsarist government's involvement in and motivations for getting involved in the Hajj. But they basically, the Soviets have global ambitions. It wasn't just supposed to be the Soviet Union. The Bolshevik Revolution was supposed to spread around the world, and socialism was supposed to spread. It was supposed to be a world revolution. So they start to see possibilities. And it's not because they support Islam or are favorable to religion at all, but they say, you know, the Hajj is this interesting thing because, yes, it's a religious ritual, but it's also a mass migratory event. And so if we can get Muslims from Afghanistan and Persia and sort of neighboring countries to make the Hajj to the Soviet Union, we have an opportunity. While they're in this country, we can show them around the country. We can basically try to indoctrinate them and get them to go back to their countries and try to spread socialism. This is a very brief experiment. It's in the late 1920s. And then, by as far as I can tell, you know, when Stalin comes along, he basically puts an end to this. So I think the last year that they do it is 1929 or 1930. And by do it, I mean they have basically revived the old Tsarist era policy of sponsoring the Hajj. They're placing ads in newspapers in Persia and you know, trying to recruit pilgrims from abroad to, during Hajj season, to take what are now Soviet railroads and steamships. And so part of it is that they're trying to raise money for this new, they're industrializing, and they need cash, foreign currency, to do this. And they see pilgrims as a source of revenue, which is true. But also there's this idea that this is this global network that will help us spread the revolution to, you know, it's already become clear that the social revolution is not going to spread, at least not right now, into Europe. So they're sort of turning to the East, and the Hajj is part of this. It's a brief story, but it's a really interesting one.
Fascinating. That's an absolute paradox. You call it a paradox, and it certainly is. You know, on one hand, trying to break down every form of Islamic symbol that existed, and the other hand, this fascination with the Hajj.
I'm